A warm welcome to our tour of Katowice Nikiszowiec. Please leave the tourist information point. You're standing in front of the tourist information point and a branch of the Katowice History Museum. And it's here that we begin our stroll around a most uncommon spot, Nikiszowiec. The history of this district of Katowice stretches back to the early years of the 20th century. At that time, this part of Upper Silesia wasn't Polish. It was German. This was the result of the partitions of Poland, the successive seizure of territory by the Russian Empire and then Kingdom of Prussia and Habsburg Austria in the second half of the 18th century. The outcome was the elimination of the sovereign state of Poland and the more or less complete division of her lands by the three powers. She was not to regain independence until 1918. So it was amidst the myriad steelworks and mines of German Silesia that the first workers' residential district was built. It was in December 1908 that the Georg von Giesch's Erben Company obtained approval to construct it. It was named Nikiszacht, which translates into the Polish Ship Nikisch. Schacht in ship are the German and Polish words for mine shaft, and Nikisch, or to give it its Polish form, and Nikisch was the given name of the company's representative, Baron Nikisch von Rosseneck. So the new quarter was named Nikisch Shaft. Now that might not have been a particularly sophisticated appellation, but it did spell out the precise location in close proximity to the colliery. Please stand with your back to the information center and then turn to your right. At the end of the street, you'll see a square. Please head in that direction. It's known as Plac Wyzwolenia, which means Liberation Square, and it's the local market square. Please stop when you get to the central area. And please take particular care. The roads here are very busy. So let me tell you something about the history of this, the city's most beautiful quarter. There's not the slightest doubt that if anyone deserved the title of founding father of Nikiszowiec, it was Anton Uttermann. The director general of the Giesch's Erben Company, he was a man who approached his work with genuine passion and enormous inventiveness. One of the tasks awaiting him when he took up the post was the development and expansion of the Giesch mine, and that brought with it the necessity of hiring around 3,000 new employees. In order to attract those people, it was essential to be able to provide them with homes close to their workplace. What was extraordinary, though, was Uttermann's personal involvement in the project. He had a precise vision of those homes and kept an eagle eye on the implementation of every smallest detail. The quarter was intended not only to be functional, but also to be architecturally interesting. He could have kept the costs down by building what were known as familoks. These were plain and simple low-rise multi-dwelling units, typical of late 19th and early 20th century workers' housing in Upper Silesia. Instead, though, he hired two architects from Charlottenburg, at the time a city near Berlin. It was those two architects, Emil and Georg Seelmann, who were to create the nearby Giesch's quarter and then Nikiszowiec. And the result is impressive, is it not? While you're still in the center of the square, have a good look around you. And while you're looking, let me play you an excerpt of the distinguished art historian Professor Eva Hoyetska's appreciation of the architect's mastery skill. Nikiszowiec has become well-nigh a legend, something wreathed in a kind of mythical aura. People say, oh, what on earth? Come on, it's ordinary residential architecture built to serve the needs of a colliery. It all happened at the beginning of the last century, before World War I. And it was then that these residential quarters were born, and whether they were connected with a large industry or with mining, they began to create a community of people having the same interests in the way they lived their lives and in the rhythms of their lives, people living within surroundings which established their own enclosed world of brick-built architecture. So let's look carefully at the architecture of Nikishovyets. It brings to mind the walls surrounding a small town. It consists of 9 large blocks with internal courtyards. Amongst the buildings, you'll see one with distinctive rose mosaics. The mining families moving into the new flats here a century ago would have felt a sense of being at home on spotting what was, for them, a familiar motif. For in designing the mosaic, the Berlin architects had reached for the folk costumes of Upper Silesia. And to be specific, for the design which adorned the ribbons of those costumes. You can see how beautiful those roses are. Nowadays, that building houses a post office and a bank. Originally, though, it was home to a Gasthaus, in other words, to an inn. It was an establishment which offered more simply a place for the miners to quench their thirst with a beer or two after their shift was over. There was also a restaurant, there were hotel rooms, and there was even a skittle alley. What's interesting is that the colliery's workers and its officials found their fun in different places. Under the communist rule of the 1950s, part of the former inn was designated as the recreation facility for the Wieczorek colliery, in other words, the former Giesche colliery. It was here that a famous group of amateur painters, known as the Janowska Group, met. Its members included Teofil Ochepka and Ewald Gawlik, who was sometimes known as the Van Gogh of Nikish, as well as Pavel Rubel and Erwin Sufka. Let's listen to the words of the last-named Erwin Sufka, a miner in his day job and a remarkable painter after hours, talking about his art. St. Barbara, patron saint of miners, is an ever-present figure in his works, as are Silesian women. They are often painted in a state of deshabille, as Sufka explains. "Ay, yes, I paint yon Barbara as if she was one of our ordinary womenfolk, and that's stuck with me right up to this day. There's times I've afeared what dreams the nights would bring. I gab away to myself. Ay, Irvin, things are awry with you now right enough. Because when you're painting a woman, you're taking a great responsibility on yourself. But it isn't that you're painting a woman, it's that you have to know how to sense that woman. You have to have her in your blood, on your brain, in your mind. You have to show her from her good side, the one like that woman would like to have, like you'd like to see her." By now you're bound to have noticed the imposing edifice of the church. Please head for it. This is St. Anne's Church. It serves as an excellent orientation point on account of its size. The tower is 50 meters high. That's something over 180 feet. Its dome soars over the quarter, marking the spot that you're heading for from afar. The church can be admired both for its dimensions and for its architectural style. The interior can hold 5,000 or even 6,000 people. It was initially intended to serve the residents of 3 places, Nikishovyets and the nearby Yanuf and Gishovyets. So now let's go into the church. Please quietly take a seat on one of the pews in the central section of the church. If it's closed or there's a service in progress, then can I suggest a stroll around the exterior? And as you go, I'll tell you about the history of the church and about the sound of its remarkable organ. Like the rest of the quarter, the church was designed by Emil and Georg Seelmann. The style is neo-Baroque. Now, that was not the style close to the heart of German architecture. It's an evident tribute to Polish-speaking Upper Silesia on the part of the architects. It was largely thanks to the determination of the first parish priest, Father Pavel Dudek, that the construction of the church was finally brought to a successful conclusion and the presbytery built. Most of the original elements of the interior have survived to this day. And of those elements, the organ is of particular worth. It has an astonishing 5,350 pipes. Please feast your eyes on the choir while I share a quote of one of Poland's most foremost organists, Professor Julian Gimbalski, talking about playing this instrument. In principle, it's one of the largest organs in Upper Silesia, in this industrial part. It has 75 ranks. And most importantly, it was built by the Reiger Brothers Company of Krnov in Czech Silesia, one of the best organ makers of the time, which was 1927. The instrument is wreathed in legend because some outstanding musical figures have been connected with it. First and foremost, the composer, conductor, concert organist, and teacher. As Nowowiejski said, an organ like this will conquer the world. Piano. First of all, I have to turn off the stops by hand. And now, with just one button, I'll change the dynamics to mezzo forte, and then to forte, and fortissimo. Now we can hear that glorious mass of sound, those dozens of ranks which are playing. And finally, tutti. It might be slightly out of tune now because the ranks which haven't been tuned are also coming into play. Now please have a look at the direction of the high altar. The figure of St. Anne, like the pulpit and baptismal font, were carved in wood by an artist from Munich, Georg Schreiner. Have a look up at the massive chandelier. It's over 4.5 meters in diameter. That's over 14.5 feet. It, too, was designed by the Seelmann Brothers Architectural Studio. Proof positive of exceptional attention to detail and scrupulously thorough design. Now let's make our way slowly back outside. Once again, let's make our way slowly back outside now. In late July, on the first Sunday after St. Anne's Day, the Nikishovyets Church always takes on a particularly festive bloom. The patron saint is commemorated not only with a procession and worship, but also with a parish fete and all the attendant fun. Saint Anne, Jesus' grandmother, is one of the saints for whom the Silesians have a particular fondness. So it's hardly surprising that on that day, the church welcomes not only its own parishioners, but also devotees of the saint from beyond the parish. Once you've left the church, please carry on straight ahead. Exactly opposite, on the other side of the square, there's a row of shops with distinctive arcades. Please head over to them and then stop in front of them. A stroll around Nikishovyets also offers an encounter with a local dialect, Sklepy, in the nominative plural in Polish. But to a born and bred Nikishlovian, they aren't Sklepy, they are Konzome. And that's a word you'd search for in a Polish dictionary in vain. This is because it's a dialect adaptation of the word konsum. In other words, a shop run by the owner of a colliery. The residents of Nikishovyets could stock up on any and every staple here, on the spot. The konsum offered foodstuffs, groceries, and alcoholic drinks, as well as draper's goods, and all at highly favorable prices. The premises has continued to house a row of shops to this day. In principle, Nikishovyets was self-sufficient. Public, commercial, and service premises were incorporated into the residential buildings. The first school, which was connected to a building providing accommodation for the teachers, was immediately commissioned into use. However, most of the buildings serving the entire community were located right here, around the Nikishovyets Market Square, officially known as Plac Wyzwolenia, Liberation Square, where you're standing at this moment. Now please stand with your back to the shops and have a look at the building to the right of the church. It houses the apteka, in other words, the chemists. please make for the sign reading Apteka and stop when you get there. This premises was designed with exactly this purpose in mind. The chemist working here had a very short commute to work. His four-room flat was located above the shop. During the interwar years, the chemist was a highly important member of the local community here. This was not only because of his education, but also on account of his character. His name was Władysław Bix, and he numbered among the quarter's most active figures. He was involved in the activities of a great many pro-Polish organizations, and also gave them his financial support. But why was there a need for pro-Polish organizations? As I mentioned earlier, in 1918, in the aftermath of the First World War, Poland reclaimed her independence. And with that came the need to rebuild a sense of nationhood. Then, in 1919, the Treaty of Versailles compelled Germany to cede swathes of her former territories to the newly restored Polish state. This included the eastern areas of Upper Silesia, and Katowice formed a part of those lands. Being rich in coal, minerals, and heavy industry, and with a population that was an ethnic mix of Poles and Germans, the region became the subject of bitter dispute. This led to two separate Silesian uprisings, as the Poles took to arms in the struggle against German rule. So in 1921, the League of Nations held a plebiscite. 60% of the inhabitants apparently voted in favor of the Germans, but the Silesians who supported Poland disputed the results, and, as an aside, they had indeed been falsified in a great many wards. And thus, the Third Silesian Uprising erupted. The result was that another third of the contested ethnically mixed territory became part of Poland. The Nikiszowians evidently recognized their chemist's involvement in all of this, since they repeatedly elected him to their local council. Unfortunately, the outbreak of World War II spelt deadly danger for active pro-Polish organizations. The task of the Nazis after the German invasion of Silesia in 1939 was not only to exterminate the Jews, but also to stamp out every single trace of Polishness. This, of course, entailed the murder of pro-Polish activists. Being aware of this, Władysław Bix left Nikiszowiec during the first few days of September 1939, fleeing eastward as the invading German forces advanced from the west. There was neither sight nor sound of him ever again. There's a longer walk ahead of you now. Please take the side street between the church and the building housing the chemists. Follow that street until you come to a distinctive three-arched entrance to the next street on the right. It's on the far side of number 14. When you reach the arched entrance, please stop there and wait for more directions. As you go, I'll share some quotes of what the Nikiszowians have to say about their corner of the earth, all of it with affection and sentiment. There's not another Nikisz to compare in all the world. It's the work of people who knew what they were about. It was built by Giesche, by Germans. First, they built themselves a brickyard, and then they did all the rest with just that one brickyard. Nikisz, Giesiowiec, and the church. That single type of brick, it's known as a clinker brick. It's a wonderful thing. This here Nikiszowiec is as varied as those windows. For example, when you look at the windows, one oval, one kind of hexagonal, square, it's the same in the flats. Like they wanted. I'm completely amazed that they wanted to build something like this for ordinary workers. Because in the normal familoks, it's just like any old wall and windows. They must have been dreadfully keen at the time, I reckon, wanting to build something nice for ordinary folk. Please don't forget to stop when you reach the arched entrance beyond number 14. When the first residents moved to Nikiszowiec, the annual rent for a larger flat was 102 marks. For the smaller ones, it ranged between 72 and 78 marks. bearing in mind the fact that the average annual earnings of an Upper Silesian miner at the time was 1,233 marks, the rents certainly weren't exorbitant. The officials working at the colliery didn't have to pay anything at all for the flats which went with the job. By now you should be standing by the distinctive arched entrance. So please turn right, go through it, and into the street it opens onto. This is Uwitsa Svienta Anine, St. Anne's Street, the most beautiful in Nikoszowiec. One of Poland's best-known film directors, Kazimierz Kutz, shot his films here. To this very day, he remains beguiled by the magic of Nikoszowiec. Let's stop for a moment and listen to him telling his tale. This is a titanic undertaking, and one which is unquestionably an historical site today. It's truly an enormous attraction, something of value already, and of a future worth which can't be determined at present. It'll be one of the wonders of Silesia, the most extraordinary place in Poland. I'm delighted that I was born nearby. Nikoszowiec was only 3 kilometers away, and I had numerous relatives there. In my first film about Silesia, about the uprisings, I was the first person to show the remarkable charm of the place. Remarkable in the magnificent, outstanding architecture of the workers' districts, designed specifically for the workers. That charm, it has a kind of strange inherent connection, an inherent relationship with the miners who disappeared to work down there and then emerged to permeate the quarter. It's as if slag heaps had been molded into a great architecture. I'm always struck by that. In a word, it might serve as a sanctuary, a preservation of that tremendous eruption of heavy industry in Silesia a century ago. So now, please continue along the street. As you pass between the residential buildings, which the inhabitants refer to as blocks, you'll notice the immense variety of the architectural details. It's only at first glance that the brick elevations might seem to be all of a kind. The balconies, bay windows, window surrounds, and doors all make every separate set of flats an original. Protruding brickwork, varied with molding, has an impact on the picturesque nature of the architecture. Just as the outwardly uniform facades of the Nikoszowian buildings differ from one to the next, so do their interiors. A typical worker's flat in the quarter consists of 2 rooms and a large kitchen and measures around 60 square meters. That's just under 646 square feet in total. Nowadays, most of them have been converted. In their original form, though, they had no bathroom. The toilets were situated on the half landings. Laundry and bathing, on the other hand, took place in a building intended especially for those purposes. The director of the colliery, Anton Utemann, was of the opinion that women should be permitted neither to launder things in their flats nor to dry them there, for that would lead to a more rapid deterioration and spread of damp, and the homes would cease to be cozy. Please stop for a moment now and have a look at the view of the church from this perspective. Stunning, is it not? And in the meantime, let's return to the story of the flats and hear the tale that a lady by the name of Stenia has to tell about hers. She was born here, in Nikoszowiec, and after an absence of 40 years, she revisited her erstwhile home. Stenia, we are here. I don't know if the main door will be open or if someone will let us in.
Good afternoon.
Hello, could you let us in because we want to have ourselves a look at where I used to live? Thank you. My God, the stairs. Now it's changed, my dear Nout. The stairs, my God, the very ones I used to soap up a lather on. Here. If you like, then I can let you into the flat. Like it is now. Afternoon. Go on in. Aye, you first. But it's all so different now. Unrecognizable. Right, because it is unrecognizable. Because there weren't a bathroom here.
It were just a kitchen. And there were never a door here. It were here.
I know.
Aye, this is where what we used to call to other chamber were.
You can go in.
That's what it were like. Aye, aye, aye. There's two windows now as well. Of course, back then it were tiled stoves everywhere.
The first room were, you know, to parlor. It were to room, you know, for when visitors came or whatever.
And that one were the marital bedroom.
But truth to tell, for casual conversation, you sat in the kitchen.
There's nowt like the kitchen.
And anyway, there's a place to set yourself down, because the kitchens were
vast.
That they were.
Goodbye.
Thank you very much.
Don't mention it.
That I will. You've given me a right treat.
Thank you very much.
Now please stand with your back to the church, then carry along this distinctive street. As you've been walking along the street, you're bound to have noticed the entryways into the interior courtyards. The women would often sit together in their courtyards, keeping an eye on their children. As they sat, they'd darn their linen and sing. Back then, there was generally a lot of music making at home, and there'd be singing outside of these buildings, like four horses in the farmyard. There'd be no ache, Yashu, in my little noggin, if you won't tie the knot with me, but to know which girl your steps are doggin', wouldn't really fill my heart with glee. The girl to whom my steps leads has a ring all golden and a necklace hung with coral beads. When you get to the crossroads, you need to go straight across. As soon as you've crossed, please look for an archway on your right. Then turn into it and go through and into the courtyard. Nowadays, the courtyards of Nikishovyets have become oases of greenery. The one you're heading for now has a children's play area, benches set under the trees for their parents and grandparents, swaths of shrubbery, and a generous sprinkling of little flower gardens. But it wasn't always so green. Apart from trees, the only thing that the director of the colliery, Anton Uteman, would permit was climbing plants by the walls of the buildings. He refused to allow shrubbery to be planted because, in his opinion, it would rapidly become a nest of dirt. Just to remind you, as soon as you've crossed the road, please turn right into the first archway and go through into the courtyard. What awaits you there is a picturesque tale of the life into square, as the locals would say. Back in the early 20th century, the courtyards were typically utilitarian and served domestic purposes. In the center, there was a bakehouse, in other words, a small building equipped with stoves, where the housewives could bake their own bread and crumb cakes. There were also small buildings which housed pigsties in numbers corresponding to the number of flats in the block in question. Every Nikishovian family could raise farm animals such as goats, pigs, rabbits, and pigeons to meet their own needs. A pig killing was a truly important event in the quarter. Let me share with you a quote of a resident, a man called Rudolph, talking about that.
Aye, the pigsties were here. We had the bakehouse here, in the middle aye, along a bar for hanging up carpets for beating and to rubbish skip. The sties were the kind as we had to place store wood up top, too. My father, he raised pigs down below, and I raised pigeons on top. Aye, and we had us a pig killing, quite regular, because there were a fair few. Father, he was always right fierce at them pigs on account of them being so many. We had a butcher, too, lived on the same staircase as us. The swimmers slaughtered them pigs all the time and made us all them products, the blood sausages with buckwheat and them with breadcrumbs. No, you couldn't go moaning that there weren't now to eat. Everyone raised their own. Everyone had summat for theirselves.
Now please leave the courtyard via the archway you came through. Once you've gone through the archway, please turn right and make for the three arches at the far end of the street. When you reach the arches, please stop there and wait for more directions. In Nikishovets, the courtyards like the one you're leaving were once places which provided a natural integration among the residents of the quarter. Pig killings aside, the women would meet at the bakehouse and the children would play together here. As indeed two born and bred Nikishlovians, ethnographer Professor Dorota Simonides and her sister recall. Oh, the creative games we came up with. We made our own theaters in the courtyards. Dressed up in old curtains, we were queens. Yes, whole scenes. We played such games. We made shift for what we didn't have and could only dream up like a fairy tale, didn't we? We had balls like this, and this is what you used to do. A movement like this. First, there's what we called a basket. In other words, a nicely dug hole, smooth, with smooth edges, so that it dropped nicely. Then everyone had, let's say, 10 balls. And whoever got the most into the basket, as we used to say, perhaps it came from the check for hole, was the winner. I got to be so good at it that I remember to this day, because when I won, and by then I had ever so many balls, then I had the right to go to another courtyard to play, to another block. In front of you, you have the three arches at the end of Owitzashviente Anane, St. Ann Street. Please go through and then go straight ahead toward the crossroads and traffic lights. Let me remind you that you will need to go straight ahead toward the crossroads and traffic lights. On the left, you should be able to see two tall chimneys. When you reach the crossroads and traffic lights, please turn left. That will take you into Owitzashapinitska Street, named after the city's former Shapinitsa district, now Shapinitsa Borovets. If you haven't reached the crossroads yet, please press pause and then turn the recording on again once you get there. We're heading toward a colliery building with a distinctive shaft. Like the rest of Nikishovets, the shaft was designed by Emil and Georg Seelmann. In principle, it could be acknowledged as being the cradle of this entire remarkable quarter. It was from here that the miners set off to their work underground. It's one of the working mining shafts in the Viatchorik Colliery. In other words, as I mentioned earlier, at the former Geisha Colliery. And it was, in fact, the opening of this shaft which made it essential to build the residential districts for the new employees required to work it. It was originally known as the Karmer, which is hardly surprising, given that this was the name of one of Georg von Geisha's company representatives. However, we might reflect on where the notion of renaming it the Kazimierz Puławski Shaft in 1935 sprang from. Kazimierz Puławski was a nobleman who fought against Russia's domination of the Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth in the late 1760s and early 1770s. He was driven into exile and emigrated to America, where he distinguished himself fighting against the British in the Revolution. He died after being mortally wounded in the Battle of Savannah. However, he is not a figure who has enjoyed overwhelming popularity in Silesia. So why was the shaft named after him? The explanation lies in the history of the Geisha concern. During the interwar years, the company's owners were American, which is how Kazimierz Puławski, Polish-American national hero, appeared in Nikishovets. You're slowly approaching the colliery. Before long, you'll see the two green railway wagons that stand at the entrance. Please go straight over to them. They may look like goods wagons on the outside, but the interiors are adapted to carry people. They served a narrow gauge railway known as the Balkan, which used to run through Nikishovets. In fact, they're all that now remains of it. The many factories and facilities that made up the Geisha concern were connected by a rail network. This was primarily so that the coal from the shafts of the various collieries could be transported directly to the steelworks located nearby, in the former Shapinitsa district.
One stretch of this extraordinary railway was also used for passenger transport. This solved the problem of getting to work for those who lived several kilometers away in the Gishovets quarter. The passenger trains would stop at each of the mine shafts in turn. You should now be by the entrance to the colliery. It's a very dangerous spot on account of the heavy goods vehicle traffic entering and leaving the site, so please take particular care as you go past the main gate. Please press pause now and then turn the recording on again once you reach the green railway wagons. We don't know who first used the name Balkan to refer to the local train, but the name stuck. Time passed, and few people remembered that it had, in fact, been a joking reference to an express train linking Berlin and Constantinople, the Balkanzug. Eventually, everyone used the Balkan, including the miners' families making their way to Mass in the church in Nikosovets. At the same time, it's worth noting that throughout its existence, travel on the railway was free. The last passenger run on the Balkan took place on the 31st of December, 1977, to the enormous displeasure of the locals. Please have a look at the information board. Right alongside the wagons, you'll find a small exhibition of 19th century boundary stones. They marked the borders of the coal seams. Underground deposits of pit coal were divided into what are known as coal seams, or coal beds. In truth, their boundaries ran underground. However, a stone boundary marker was set up on the surface. The stones were customarily engraved with the emblem of mining. Sadly, it's rather indistinct here. The emblem depicts two mining tools, the hammer and the pick. The engraving also consisted of a monogram symbolizing the name of the mine and the date that the stone was set up. Now you need to return to the market square. So please set off back towards the crossroads and traffic lights. And again, please be careful of the heavy goods vehicle traffic. Please press pause now and then turn the recording on again once you're on the right-hand side of the main gate. It was in 1946 that the Giesche Colliery was renamed the Wieczorek. But no matter what the name, for a long time it was the sole source of support for the families of Nikosovets. It provided employment first for all the men living here, then later for women as well, and in critical situations, even children. However, it was not merely a workplace. By and large, the life of the entire quarter was focused around the colliery. It was the colliery that established most of the ways for the locals to spend their free time. It maintained sports facilities, running a swimming pool and ice rink. It also had its own arts and culture center. For over a century now, the colliery has had its own brass and woodwind band. It's an inseparable part of every mining high day, holiday, and first and foremost, of the greatest feast day of them all. That falls on the 4th of December, St. Barbara's Day. As I mentioned earlier, she's the patron of miners, and their traditional celebration of their saint is known as Barburka. Let me share a quote of the conductor of the Wieczorek Colliery Band, Andrei Pisarzowski, talking with pride about his work and about the annual 4th of December Barburka procession. "We all assemble very early in the morning, at 6 o'clock. For us musicians, that's like the middle of the night. We change into our uniform. It consists of the miner's own special dress uniform and the chako. That's the special hat. The ones for the band members have a red plume, and the bandmaster's has a red and white one. Then, no matter what the weather, freezing, snowing, or wet, we set out. We march, and at the same time, we play a march, and that march, which is known as the reveille, is what they call a miner's tradition, because people don't even know why the band marches out on the 4th of December. It's a tradition connected with the fact that On the 4th of December, the band used to wake up the locals and then lead them to the church and mass. You should now be approaching the crossroads and traffic lights. Please carry on straight ahead. But as you'll notice, the pavement doesn't run directly beside the road. It's set back somewhat, to the right. Meanwhile, I'll share with you more of the conductor's story. Last year's Borborka was so cold, there was so much snow that it was hard to play. Well, for us, after all, it's also that we're playing for people who can't always get to our concerts. We can see them at their windows, behind the net curtains, and that's a wonderful thing for us. They wave to us as we march through Nikishovets, and then they recall the band and the kinds of traditions that there are fewer and fewer of in Poland nowadays. Two of the band members work down the pit, but the rest are retired from the colliery, or on annuities from it. There's a lot of youngsters. It's a two-generational band, and that's cheering because you've got father and son playing, and father and daughter playing. Maybe we'll live to see three generations, because it's already highly likely that the daughter's old enough now that in time she'll also be bringing the grandchild along to the band. I don't know if I'll live to see that. You should be passing a T-junction on the right. It leads to Ulica Janowska, Janowska Street. Please carry on straight ahead. The buildings you're passing as you go are typical Nikishovian homes. In a moment, you'll reach a building which housed a hostel for single minors. It was originally referred to in German as the Schlafhaus. During the interwar years, it officially operated under the designation of dormitory. Then, for several decades, it was simply known as a workers' or employees' hotel. In the main, it was young miners who hadn't yet got married that lived there, or else married men who had left their native village in search of a livelihood. A canteen was built for use solely by the residents of the Schlafhaus. This was an absolutely deliberate move on the part of the director of the mining company building the quarter. It was intended to limit contact between the families who settled here permanently and newcomers from sometimes far-flung points. And indeed, in August 1919, when the first of the Silesian uprisings that I mentioned earlier erupted, the fighting here in Nikishovets broke out in the grounds of what was then the miners' dormitory. The insurgents attacked the building, where a few days previously a detachment of the Grenzschutz, the German border guards, had been quartered. In truth, the attack was unsuccessful on account of the fact that the insurgents were poorly armed. Nonetheless, it wasn't long before the Germans, fearing that the building would be surrounded, left it of their own accord. Within just a few days, the insurgents succeeded in taking control of the entire quarter. You should now be approaching another T-junction. And the building on the far side, on the right, is the very same workers' hotel that I've just been telling you about. Nowadays, it houses a restaurant where once there was a canteen. But our tour takes you into the street on the right. So please turn right into Ulica Bernarda Krawczyka, Bernard Krawczyk Street. Let me remind you that you should now be walking along Ulica Bernarda Krawczyka, Bernard Krawczyk Street. To help you get your bearings, you should see the distinctive church tower ahead of you. Something that's worth having a look at on this street is the Niesporek family's photographic studio. It's located in what was originally the police station, which also housed the police cells. So please keep a careful lookout. It's on the end of the street, on the right. The door to the studio is set into an arched surround. You'll see the sign reading Photo. That's F-O-T-O. And the name, Niesporek, N-I-E-S-P-O-R-E-K, above the arch. And there's a sign with the date, 1919, in yellow, on a red background set into the triangular pediment over the arch. Once you reach the studio, please wait for the next instructions. But while you're making your way there, I'll tell you something about its history.
The Neosporics studio has been operating in Nikishovets since 1919. Like just about everyone hereabouts, the first owner, Augustin Neosporic, worked at the Geisha mine. As a photographer, he was self-taught. To start with, it was simply a hobby he loved, a way of spending his spare time. But before long, it turned out that the Nikishovians were only too willing to avail themselves of his services. Particularly, of course, when it came to important family celebrations. Subsequent generations of Neosporics treated photography as a livelihood, just as Christoph Neosporic does today. Let me share what he has to say about what the family tradition means to him. The studio and the flat were connected. Part of this room was the atelier, where the studio was a studio from 9 to 5, and then after 5, my grandmother cleaned it, and it was the living room. In Nikishovets, it was always the case that when people went to the shop, they wouldn't say that they were going to the shop. They'd say they were going to Legia's, for instance, because Legia, she was the manager of the shop they were heading for. Or that they were going to Boris's, because Mrs. Boris was the manager of another shop. And when they came here, they'd say that they were going to Neosporics. We're off to Neosporics to get a photo taken. Every ceremony connected with everyday life was photographed. Photographers would go to the christenings to photograph the baby, then in Silesia to the first form in primary school. Next came First Communion, and then, well, the wedding and the funeral. In other words, 6 moments, if you like, to be photographed. Well then, how about a group photo of us all here and now? We could take it here outside my studio. The light's good at the moment, so I'd say, let's stand here, all of us, and have our photo taken. And Christoph Nisporik's suggestion is well worth taking up, because Nikishovets is tailor-made for photographing. Now please stand with your back to the photographers, then make your way straight ahead to the square, which you're now familiar with, of course. You're now going to be strolling back to the tourist information point, where you borrowed this audio guide. As I mentioned at the start of our walk, a museum is also housed in that same building. And it's a building with a history that's well worth hearing. In bygone times, it was home to a laundry, a powerful press, and a public bathhouse. As I told you earlier, the majority of the flats in Nikishovets were devoid of bathrooms. However, the quarters residents, or perhaps I should say its female residents, had at their disposal a building equipped with the very latest in appliances. A building where, within the space of a few hours, they could not only deal with all their laundering tasks, but could also have a bath while they were at it. So the ground floor held the laundry, which offered stone troughs for hand washing. For linens, there were electric boilers and electric spinners. Meanwhile, you should now be approaching the square. Please follow the bend to the left and make for the tourist information point. And I'll tell you the rest of the building's history as you go. In the large room on the first floor, there was an airing cupboard fed with warm air for drying the laundry. There was also an electric press for eliminating every last crease from starched tablecloths and bed linens. Both floors also housed a kind of kindergarten, where mothers could leave their young children under a watchful eye while they get on with the laundry. As I said before, the building also housed a public bathhouse. It was equipped with baths and showers and was intended primarily for women and children, since the men, the miners, bathed in the baths at the mines after their shifts. You remember the lady by the name of Stenia, who revisited her former home in the quarter? She also recalls the former laundry and press with absolute clarity. So before we finish our stroll around this remarkable quarter, let me share with you her poignant recollections. My life passed in the shadow of to laundry and to press. Now there's a statement with two meanings, because here's to laundry, and I lived opposite. And it's not just because the shadow of that building kept the sun out of our home, but because I spent a heap of time in the press room.
into laundry. By way of making a living, my mother, I'm going to break out crying in a minute, she took in laundry, washed other people's linens, plain and simple. I have come to terms with that. And so you've reached the museum, which once housed the laundry. Let me share with you the last extract of what Stenia has to say about it. In Silesia, doing the laundry were especially important thing. It weren't like nowadays, full washing machine every other day now, isn't it? But the laundry were right popular, and as for the press, 3 times a year, that were a real crowd puller. Before Christmas, before Easter, and before St. Anne's Day, and to parish fete and all. And there weren't a thing didn't go through the press, my dear. You started with the big items, in other words, with the bed linen sheets, pillowcases and all, along with the tablecloths and curtains. Then you did the undershirts and all those kinds of things, including drawers and socks. And last of all, to working clothes you'd laundered. They all went through to press as well. And when it came to pressing drawers, that were a philosophy all by itself, because you had to know how to feed them through so as not to go stretching the elastic. All the ladies were after doing their pressing here, you know, and here there was a bench. And to women waiting into queue for to press, they sat here and had themselves a good old chin wag about everything. What had been going on, who'd died, who'd had a baby, who'd, well, there's not women can't talk about along those lines. It were a ritual. It weren't written in stone. But it were a ritual for all that. And if someone were to go doing aught else, then that were frowned on somewhat terrible. A Roman forum of its own kind, a place for meeting and the exchange of gossip and rumor. Finally, I'd like, if I may, to suggest that you visit the museum and enjoy the exhibitions there. It's certainly well worth it. And with that, I have to bid you farewell. Thank you for following the tour. I wish you an enjoyable time here in Nikashovets.